It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
I'm Charles Payne.
I'm Martha McCallum.
I'm Greg Jarrett, and this is the Fox News Rundown.
Friday, March 22nd, 2024. I'm Chris Foster. He beat Donald Trump again. President Biden tells Black and Latino voters, I need you.
He is slipping with groups that Democrats really did not think they would have problems with, especially in a head-to-head matchup with President Trump. But he's been making inroads in ways that other Republican candidates have not done.
We're speaking with Fox News Sunday host Shannon Bream.
I'm Dana Perino. The American workplace has transformed in the past 5 years, and it's not just where Americans are working that's shifted. Why Americans are working has changed as well.
But I think this is a kind of a millennial concept of work-life balance that I don't blame them for coming up with, because the baby boomers told them there was something called retirement where you can check out altogether for 30 years. So if you're going to end your life in a 30-year vacation, I guess you're entitled to have the balance of yoga class at 4 in the afternoon.
And I'm Jimmy Failla. I've got the final word on the Fox News Rundown.
The next presidential primaries are tomorrow for Democrats in Missouri, Democrats and Republicans in Louisiana. Former President Trump voted in Florida's Republican primary Tuesday.
I voted for Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Did somebody just say, who'd you vote for? Yeah, I voted for Donald Trump. Thank you.
President Biden's been campaigning in Nevada, Arizona, and Texas this week, appealing to Latino voters at a Mexican restaurant in Phoenix, Arizona.
You're the reason why, in large part, I beat Donald Trump.
Yes. Let's beat him again.
His support with Black and Latino voters is lower than it was against Trump in 2020.
While Democrats are worried about an enthusiasm problem with President Biden and some of these groups that are shifting over to the Trump camp, what also motivates Democrats is Donald Trump being on the ballot.
Fox News Sunday and Living the Bream podcast host Shannon Bream.
Whether they're super excited about President Biden, whether they decide to stay home, whether they decide to cross over, what is going to happen is that people who love President Trump are going to show up. People who hate President Trump are going to show up. So the Biden campaign has to hope enough of those folks who don't really feel excited about voting for Biden in some of these groups, that enough of them feel motivated to vote against President Trump. But he is slipping with groups that Democrats really did not think they would have problems with, especially in a head-to-head matchup with President Trump. But he's been making inroads in ways that other Republican candidates have not done in a long time. He breaks all the rules, as we know.
We had more primaries this week. Trump and Biden would 5 more states. Well, 5 for Biden if you count Florida, which canceled this primary and just gave it to him. Since they were obviously going to win, analysts are sort of looking under the hood. In Florida and Ohio, about 1 in 7 voters chose Nikki Haley instead of Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. And these are presumably pretty engaged voters who bother to come out to vote in a decided primary. Does it mean anything or not?
Well, you know, the Trump people will say those were voters that we were never going to get. They point to the fact that a lot of, you know, Haley donors are now going over to the Biden team versus showing up for the GOP nominee and saying, okay, we'll pour our money this way. Their argument has always been that Nikki Haley is pulling from people who wouldn't have voted for Trump anyway. And I do think there's definitely some segment of that. It will be interesting to see, though, if those voters, quote unquote, go home or come home. I'm not sure the GOP was home for a lot of the Nikki Haley voters. So there's definitely a segment that says, I'm a never Trumper, though. I'm definitely not going to vote for him, even within the GOP. So we haven't seen a ton of outreach from the Trump campaign going to those Haley voters and where they could end up, you know, in contrast to what we've seen from the Biden campaign saying, you've got a home here with us. Come home to us.
I mean, some of those Haley voters could be what they're calling, and I like this a lot, what they're calling double haters.
Right.
Who don't want either candidate. And those voters could end up deciding the election, whether they tip one way or the other or just stay home.
Yeah. And Chris, I think we have such an interesting vibe, I guess, that's going on in this primary, not primary, in that there are people showing up to vote knowing that their candidate or their cause is not going to win, but they're taking time out of their day to actually go vote. We think about the more than 100,000 people in Michigan who voted uncommitted against the current president because they're very angry. We think mostly in part about how he's handling Israel and Gaza. But again, these Nikki Haley voters have shown up in numbers knowing that she's not going to best President Trump in these early states. They knew she would get clobbered, but it was enough of a protest that they showed up. So we've got a lot of people who do not, and we knew this a year ago in the polling, they told us we do not want this rematch, but they're ticked off enough about it. They're taking time to go and vote and let you know they don't want it, even though they know that's what they're getting.
New Trump campaign fundraising numbers out a couple days ago for February. They brought in $20 million. That's up. Campaign has $42 million in cash on hand. Now, it's compared to the Biden campaign, $53 million in fundraising in February. Again, Trump, $42 million cash in the bank. Biden, $155 million cash on hand. Any insight into why there's such a big gap? And I wonder what effect changes that the Republican National Committee might have on fundraising.
Yeah, it feels like to me, I don't know what you think, but I feel like the Biden campaign is just really starting the general election in earnest. Trump has been campaigning for well over a year for this primary fight. A lot of his money, tens of millions of those dollars, have gone into legal fights. I mean, they're just burning through an enormous amount of money. But he's been pulling from the donors for a much longer period of time. I think the Biden-Harris campaign is really just starting to do that in earnest. They had a great bounce out of the State of the Union. They did have good numbers on that front. They didn't get the bounce in the polls. So the Trump folks, I think, are feeling that they're going to continue coasting on what they think is better polling. But they've really been at the fundraising and spending for a year that the Biden campaign has not had to do it. So it feels like maybe for their donors, they're going to a lot of them for the first, maybe second time, where the Trump folks are going to them fourth, fifth, sixth time. And at some point, the money is going to not catch up.
Yeah. Did you follow the Supreme Court arguments about the social media censorship case this week? The questioning seemed to suggest, on the face of it, that the justices didn't necessarily think the Biden administration did anything illegal communicating with these social media companies about posts that considered disinformation. The question is, you know, coercion versus suggestion versus illegally sticking your thumb on the scale.
Yeah, because, I mean, there's obviously the legal principle and the precedent out there that the government can't pressure a private institution to the point that it is speaking what the government demands of it. So there's that whole question about how far is too far when they reach out and, you know, they want what they call misinformation, disinformation taken down. Some of what they were pressing on with regard to COVID turned out to be factual. So there's got to be a consideration of how influential the government can be over private companies when it comes to speech. So, yeah, I think this is going to be a very narrow ruling when we eventually get it. But I think it was troubling to people to hear one of the justices, Justice Jackson, say, you know, the way you're arguing this case, the First Amendment hamstrings the government, which is what a lot of people think that the Bill of Rights and the amendments are supposed to do, is to rein in the government. So I don't think there's going to be any kind of sweeping ruling in either direction. But I think there is a feeling among the justices, some of them, probably the majority, maybe a very slim one, that there has to be some kind of guideline so that the government isn't essentially forcing private companies to parrot only the speech it thinks is acceptable.
Right. Explain what happened with the Supreme Court and this Texas immigration law. Now, making it a state crime to illegal entry, a state crime, and letting local law enforcement arrest, prosecute, deport people suspected of being here illegally. Now, it was enforceable for just a few hours. Why did a lower court then get to freeze it again and so quickly?
So this is super wonky and strange. But what the Supreme Court said when it issued its decision earlier this week, it said if the Fifth Circuit had issued a stay pending appeal, then we would have to go through this four-factor test. This is what we would be looking at. But they didn't do that. There was sort of an administrative stay in place. So then the Fifth Circuit immediately steps up and says, okay, we are now going to address this issue of the stay that we didn't put into place before. So essentially, the Supreme Court seemed to be signaling, like, we're answering the question that's before us, but the Fifth Circuit hasn't taken the stay action, which is what we really probably should be answering that question. So the Fifth Circuit immediately jumps up and says, okay, we're going to have this expedited hearing and get to that point the Supreme Court made. So Fifth Circuit not overruling the Supreme Court, which obviously couldn't do, but the Supreme Court saying we can only make a decision up to this point, and then the Fifth Circuit jumping in to say, like, okay, we're now going to take that action that you would have been considering.
Yeah, because the headline was Supreme Court says Texas is okay. Well, sort of, not really. They did. That wasn't the question they were answering.
Right. And it's so it's all procedural and wonky at this point. They haven't gotten to the merits of this. I think this case does end up at the Supreme Court on the merits. I think they probably take it up. Echoes of Arizona's SB 1070 years ago. We haven't gotten that far. What we're just arguing about at this point is whether the law can be enforced while they're arguing the case on the merits, as we know, takes time.
4 years ago this week, California was the first state to order people to stay home as much as possible because of the brand new ish coronavirus pandemic. It was the most drastic measures at that point. Governor Gavin Newsom was either praised for his decisiveness or criticized for going overboard. Like you said, I mean, mistakes were made and there's still books to be written with hindsight about what we did right, what we did wrong then. Politically, though, are we past it? I mean, a couple of years ago, people like Gavin Newsom might have been vilified on one hand or not on the other. Do we even care anymore? Is it a campaign issue?
You know what? There are a lot of parents who care out there. That's who I hear from who say there has got to be some accountability for the absolute havoc this wreaked on my child's life. Because for us adults, I mean, it was a horrible time period. Everybody was trying to do the best they could with the information they understood at the point. But for kids, this was a huge chunk of their life, whether we're talking about a five-year-old or a high school kid who misses all of the stuff. The college experience, the potential for scholarships, because you couldn't play athletic teams if that's what you were trying to go to school on. I mean, there were just so many things. Kids isolated, really big mental health issues for kids. So what I hear from parents who are angry and say, oh, no, I still expect somebody to be held accountable for this, whether that's enough to make a dent in the campaign trail, I don't know. But there's still people who feel like there is accountability that has not been meted out. And they intend to see it.
March Madness underway. Do you care? Do you know? Do you have any picks? Did you do a bracket?
I have not. But what I like to do is pick based on the mascots and the uniforms. I call them costumes. My husband corrects me. They're uniforms. Because the only ballot that's going to make history is the one that picks all kinds of crazy stuff and gets lucky.
Sure.
So that's my philosophy. What about you?
I don't know a lot about college basketball. It's not necessarily my sport. I kind of try to just look at consensus and people I trust and then, I kind of do wisdom of the masses when I fill out the brackets. And then you throw in a couple crazy picks just to, because you're not going to win if you just pick favorites the whole time.
No. And in around here in the DMV area where I am, Northern Virginia, D.C., Maryland, when George Mason had its Cinderella thing years ago, and there were only like three brackets in the whole world that had them proceeding the way that they did, it was such a great story. And we loved it here locally. So I'm always pulling for the very strange, upset Cinderella kind of person.
Yeah. That's the fun of the tournament, I guess. Shannon Bream, Fox News Sunday host, Living the Bream podcast host. Thank you.
Thanks, Chris.
Hey, it's Clay Travis. Join me for Outkick the Show as we dive deep into a mix of topics. New episodes available Monday to Friday on your favorite podcast platform and watch directly on outkick.com/watch.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
Hey there, it's me, Kennedy. Make sure to check out my podcast, Kennedy Saves the World. It is 5 days a week, every week. Download and listen at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.
This is Jimmy Failla with your Fox News commentary coming up.
The American workplace is constantly changing. The rapid transformation of where we work was ushered in by the pandemic. In 2023, a Forbes study found nearly 40% of full-time employees either work from home or on a hybrid model. But with the prevalence of social media, more and more young Americans are online sharing their blunt, personal thoughts on the traditional 9-to-5 and the state of work culture. For decades, Americans have defined themselves in part by their work. Now, the younger generation in the workforce are pushing back on this idea, saying they work to live, not live to work. How did we reach this reflection point in the workplace? One where Americans are now reconsidering what kind of purpose can be found in a full-time job.
You know, for myself, first of all, just at a young age in life, work was such a therapeutic diversion.
David Bahnsen is the founder and managing partner of his wealth management firm, The Bahnsen Group, and author of the new book, Full Time, Work and the Meaning of Life.
My dad died when I was 20. He was 47, and he was like my hero. Mm. And my mom was already gone. And so I just started adult life working, and work was a healthy therapeutic way to kind of get through that and gave me purpose, gave me something to channel my energies in. So I felt strongly about it. And then as I've worked and worked throughout my career, I've constantly felt this bizarre dynamic that people in our society seem really hesitant to be judgmental of those that don't work, but they sure don't mind judging people that do work. You know, you all constantly hearing the fury of you work too much and so forth. And then it was COVID. It was just the COVID moment. Everyone looking for every excuse they could to not go back to the office. And you hear all the time how depressed everybody is, how alienated they are, how polarizing things are. And I think, yeah, I think a job might help that sociological dynamic.
Let's go back a little bit. So what did you do? What did you first start doing when you were 20? What were you working in? How did you decide or how did you know what you wanted to do?
I had no idea what I wanted to do. I couldn't do what I wanted to do because my dad had a PhD in philosophy. He was this brilliant Christian intellectual. And I wanted to be a thinker, but I also wanted to make money. And I had no path to go to college or any of these things. I had friends who were in a band. I started managing their band. I didn't know how to do it. I just worked and worked and worked, and I sold the company, made money, and, you know, it gave me something to do for those years. I got to a point where I didn't really want to deal with band members anymore, so I got to change what I was doing. But by then, I had a lot of self-confidence. I had accomplished things, and I got through that difficult period of life. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, I went into Wall Street, began a career in finance. I'm skipping over a lot of years quickly, but that was pretty much the path, and I wouldn't recommend it for everyone, but it worked really well for me.
So I do feel that I love to do mentoring. I feel I'm a little bit out of my depth on two particular questions. One is this idea of a work-life balance. Mm-hmm. And there's an obsession with this question, like how do you get the perfect work-life balance? And I get the sense, especially with younger women, that they look at their peers and they think, oh, she's got it all figured out.
Yeah.
I had that happen recently where this young woman wanted an update on her mentoring. You know, she used to be a young mentee of mine, and now she's got a pretty high-powered job, but about to have a family. And she said, I'm just worried and worried. And she said, I look at this other colleague of ours, and everything's going so well in her life. And I said, are you kidding me? Do you know how often that young woman comes in my office? And I said, everybody is going through something. And to me, the work-life balance is something that there's just no perfect answer to. And I just work. Like I love work. And I'm very fortunate. I love what I do. I love the people that I work with. I don't know how to have more balance. I actually feel like my life is balanced. So I don't know how to answer that question. And I heard you talking a little bit about it on The Editors. I wonder if you could do that for us here.
Well, I can, because the whole question is kind of what bothers me. I mean, the answer becomes problematic because I think the existence of work-life balance is a mirage. First of all, I make the argument that work is a vital and integral part of our life. So how do you balance something that's a part of your life with your life? And I ask people, and I'm being sarcastic, but it's a good point. How many of you go home and say to your spouse, sorry, honey, I'm working on marriage-life balance tonight. I can't really talk to you right now. It wouldn't go very well. We don't balance marriage with our life. It's a part of our life. Work is a part of our life. Children, church, community, whatever the different things are. And so this myth of a compartmentalization that you can do a perfect asset allocation. In the book, I use the analogy of a closet, that you're just going to have a section of shirts and a section of sweaters, and you know your closet just comes out perfect in the end. No, sometimes closets are messy. Sometimes you're short on certain clothing items, and other times you can't find things. For me, there have been a lot of times in my career, I have three children. I like to think I've done okay with them. But, you know, there were times I did not come home for dinner because I had to work late. And there were times where I was leaving the office to go to a kid's soccer game or school event. That's just life. But I think this is a kind of a millennial concept of work-life balance that I don't blame them for coming up with, because the baby boomers told them there was something called retirement where you can check out altogether for 30 years. So if you're going to end your life on a 30-year vacation, I guess you're entitled to have the balance of yoga class at 4 in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that's the way life works or is supposed to work. I think we're supposed to be productive all the time and integrate these various components and values and priorities into our day-to-day routine. It's seasonal.
What do you tell people who say, yeah, okay, well, I get that, but my boss, you know, is a monster and contacting me at all hours of the night and don't understand, he or she doesn't understand that I need some time. What do you do
with a boss like that?
Well, it's funny because the technology is a big problem now, right? Mm-hmm. Even for myself, I am my boss running my own business, and yet it's very difficult to unplug. So it takes discipline. It takes habits. These days, bosses are sort of begging for trouble because they know they kind of can't do that. Like, I sort of wish I could have connectivity with people over weekends and evenings more, but you sort of aren't allowed to. But it's a conversation one has to have with their employer and just set boundaries. But I would say it's boundaries two ways. Like the notion of I will not look at my phone after hours, there's no free lunch, as we say in economics, that you can do that and maybe the boss will honor it. You're probably not going to be climbing the ladder the way you want. So there's a sense in which you have to be available for the advancement of the company if you're vested in its success. But at the same time, the boss needs to respect your boundaries when you are with kids and things like that. These things are not rocket science. I mean, we all figure out a way to make it work, but you have to communicate.
That's the thing. My husband has always told me that every problem in every office or organization where there's a problem, it came down to a miscommunication or a lack of communication. So communication being so important. The other issue that I have a hard time talking with young people about is going into the office. Now, a lot of people want to be in the office, and some of these jobs are not in the office. But the importance of being around people and being there for the meeting in the hallway or the out of sight, out of mind issues that are going on are of concern to me. And I don't know how to advise people on that.
Well, the first thing I say is, because the appendix of my book is about this, I feel very strongly, and I was writing about it all through COVID. I was on Fox and Friends talking about it one day.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote a letter to every CEO on Wall Street. And it's funny, there's a lot of kind of baby boomer CEOs. You, Jamie Dimon at JP Morgan, David Solomon at Goldman Sachs, they've wanted everyone back. The city here in New York seems very crowded. Other cities, not so much. But what I say to younger people, which is what you're asking about, is do you do good work? And they say, yeah, I work hard, whether I'm remote or in the office. I'm working hard. I say, if you're doing good work, would you like anyone else to see it? Do you want to be seen? Do you want to be noticed? Do you want to have a chance meeting with the boss in the elevator? For me, I think it's incredibly selfish of Gen X and baby boomers because every one of us was mentored by people. And I was mentored by people in the hallway. Mm-hmm. In the coffee room, you know, walking up and down. And so in finance, it's research with analysts, with traders, with advisors, with clients. It's real time. So it's been a huge competitive advantage for our business that clients can come in and see us face to face. But just as much as some people don't want to go in, there's a lot that are craving the community and the collaboration. And it's become a hiring advantage for my firm that we're 5 days a week in office. I really believe that most people want that energy. There's certain sectors, certain industries, it's a little different. But look at all the companies that said they were done in office, and now they've all brought everyone back. The really cool tech companies that have gone back on what they said, Google, Apple, Amazon, Facebook, media companies, Netflix, and Disney, they all have everybody coming back. And so I know they're trying hybrid and so forth, but the three words I use are brand, collaboration, and culture. You can't build culture on a Zoom in yoga pants from your bedroom. And if everyone's just being honest, they're not working as hard 5 days a week. They're just not.
Bernie Sanders, a senator from Vermont, suggests that we should go to a 32-hour work week. And it's almost as if he thinks the government has helped people get to a point that he could suggest that. Well, I mean, actually, that's not how this works, sir. But what do you think about the idea of a 4-day work week?
You know, what's so interesting. As a lifetime conservative, I'm so used to being accused of being the elitist. And I thought it was one of the most elitist things I'd ever heard because he said, well, AI has made it that we can do things more efficiently. And I was just wondering if he wants to say that to the blue collar people that work at laundromats and our busboys service business. This was the whole thing during COVID policy. It was really cute ideas for certain people, but it wasn't going to work for others that have to punch in, punch out. They can't do it in 32 hours. And people paid hourly, they don't want that. So he's suggesting something for a certain segment, a more managerial, mid-level white-collar profession. First of all, the entrepreneurs and risk-takers society are never going to do it. Okay, it's just, it's not in their DNA. My wife would not let me work 32 hours. She would be forcing me out of the house to go find something to do. So it's totally unrealistic. It's statist, but it also misses the point of why we work. It is not merely that we can work less, so we should. I believe that God made us to work. I believe he gave us purpose and dignity in work. So the presupposition of a Vermont senator that what we're all trying to do is work less is, I think, incredibly arrogant and misguided. He doesn't reflect a good understanding of the human person.
Zoom way out and talk to me about where we are right now with the culture of work and our own national competitiveness in a very interesting time with the technological revolution and our adversaries on the march.
So everybody says that China's our adversary, but we don't act like it when it comes to work because we say we want to work less and they want to work more. It's a very good thing that Europe has not been a very worthy adversary when it comes to economic productivity because they've long ago kind of given into this idea of less work. I think that America has to gauge itself against what it's capable of, its own productive capacity, and we're underperforming what we can be as a country. We can be more economically productive. The largest segment of that is men that are between the ages of 20 and 49. 55 plus, there's a certain amount that have retired. We've talked about that. But that number isn't going lower. The labor participation force bruise, as I see it, is not with women at all. And it's largely with men. And I think that this notion of prime working age men that are living at mom's basement till they're 30-something years old, I think it needs to stop. It's not good for the soul of society. It's not that I want to shame them or insult them or make fun of them, but it's that I care about them, and I don't think that they are living the full, fulfilled life they're capable of.
Beautiful. David Bahnsen, thank you.
Thank you, Dana.
And now, some good news with Tanya J. Powers.
Amelia Bernard is just 5 years old, but she recently marked a major milestone in her life. She completed her final chemo treatment. Boston 25 reports that she's battled leukemia for more than 2 years, and this week she was taken to that final treatment in style. She rode in a limo with a police and fire escort to Hasbro Children's Hospital in Providence, Rhode Island, and she was surrounded by friends, family, and even the mayor when she walked in. The motorcade was organized by Enzo's Escorts, a Rhode Island police and fire organization that offers children VIP escorts to and from their homes on their last day of cancer treatment. It was started 4 years ago, and since then, they've provided 40 escorts. Amelia's mom, Carly Bernard, said the final treatment was like a light at the end of the tunnel, and she says it didn't feel real.
I'm so happy that Amelia is done and can go back to whatever normal is, but it's also like a huge chapter of our life closing.
One of the normal things Amelia has on the horizon? Starting kindergarten in the fall. Tanya J. Powers, Fox News.
I'm Emily Campagno, host of the Fox True Crime Podcast. Far too often, women's lives are cut short as they fall victim to unthinkable crimes. But each week this month, I'll be joined by women who fought back, survived, and took back control. You won't want to miss this month's stories of survival, strength, and resilience. Listen and download on Apple, Spotify, and foxnewspodcasts.com.
Subscribe to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com.
It's time for your Fox News commentary.
Jimmy Failla.
What's on your mind?
Where is Kate Middleton? That's the question a lot of people are asking after Catherine, the Princess of Wales, seemed to disappear out of the public eye a few months back. Now, to be honest, I'm not an expert on what goes on at the palace. If anything, I know more about the Kansas City Royals than the British ones, but the hysteria hooked me into the story. It started last week when Kate posted a photo of her and her kids that was later taken down because the palace admitted to photoshopping it. Now, I don't see the outrage about photoshopping pics because, if we're being honest, everybody photoshops every single picture they ever post online. I'm not kidding when I say that back when I was a cab driver, I once saw a guy photoshop a picture of his junk before he sent it to somebody. Crazy story, but it was nice to meet Anthony Weiner. But as for Kate's Photoshop fiasco, at the very least, we should all be able to agree that it's nice to see a royal taking pictures with underage kids besides Prince Andrew. But none of that was enough to stop the rumor mill from churning out one wild story after another. Some said she was trying to distract from bigger health issues for King Charles. Others claimed Prince William was having an affair and she left him a Dear John letter. Or a Dear John Thomas, if you're picking up what I'm putting down in the royal bedroom. Regardless, she's doing a much better job of getting privacy than Prince Harry and Meghan Markle, who were so committed to escaping the public eye that they started a podcast and a Netflix series. And you'd think the Kate chaos would have died down after a video surfaced this week of her shopping at an English farm stand with Prince William. But things have only gotten crazier, with many people now insisting it wasn't her because she died and they're using a body double. Okay, that's insane. But I guess it's better than propping up a dead person like we're doing with our president here in America. The point is, we don't actually know where Kate Middleton is. But I can guarantee you she's in a much better mental state than the people speculating about her. Be sure to listen to Fox Across America with me, Jimmy Fallon, weekdays from noon to 3 on the Fox News app, foxacrossamerica.com. Buy my new book, Cancel Culture Dictionary, wherever fine books are sold. And tune into Fox News Saturday Night with me, Jimmy Fallon, every Saturday at 10 p.m.
You've been listening to the Fox News Rundown. And now, stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com. From the Fox News Podcasts Network. Subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.